everyone. This is Michelle Zeman, and of course, I have been and will be your host tonight of Safe Space, the ABA podcast. Be sure to listen to those two code words so that way you can get your free CEUs when you listen to the podcast. So tonight I am very excited to be speaking with these two very lovely ladies. Erica Ronade and Lauren Toby of the Psychobabble BCBAs. Welcome to the podcast, ladies.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks so much for having us.
Hi. So happy to be here.
Yes, me too. Me too. Really excited to get into tonight's topic. We're going to be talking a little bit about their book that's coming up. So I'm so excited to hear all about this book. But first, before we even dive into that, let's talk about how you got here. What led you here? What got you to this point?
Yeah, absolutely. So Lauren and I go back, what is it now, Lauren? Are we on 15 years of friendship at this point?
Yeah, just about.
I think we just hit that. So Lauren and I met back in 2009 at our graduate program at Illinois State University. We were both studying school psychology, and we just became very fast friends. We bonded over concerts and our shared love of all things psychology and behavior analysis at the time. And we have kind of just continued on that relationship. This book has been really many years in the making. So I kind of continued my program. I got my specialist degree in school psychology, went on to work as a board certified behavior analyst out in Washington, D.C. for a while, focusing in early intervention and providing bilingual services for Spanish speaking families. And then I've kind of been along the East Coast and in the Midwest working as a licensed psychological practitioner, behavior analyst, and school psychologist. So that's kind of been my journey. I'll let Lauren kind of cue you into a little bit about her background as well.
Awesome.
Thanks, Erica. So as Erica mentioned, the two of us have a long history, and in terms of, you know, practicing. So I am a licensed psychologist and a BCBA for about 10 years now. I've practiced in a variety of settings, but most of my work has been with the autism and intellectual disabilities population. I currently work for a nonprofit in Indiana, and I oversee their diagnostic testing services. I also oversee their psychological services department. So that includes social skills groups, support groups for caregivers and siblings, as well as some more traditional therapy for autistic teenagers.
That is so cool. And, you know, you guys have had this longstanding friendship, and now you have a book that is going to be coming out very soon, The Psychology Essentials for Behavior Analysts. So tell us a little bit about this book and what inspired you to write it.
Sure. So Psychology Essentials, it really attempts to fill in some of the gaps that we see right now in the current behavior analytic training curriculum. And our goal was to provide some introductory level knowledge on a variety of topics that aren't currently taught in the coursework of most programs. So Erica and I, we both consider ourselves psychologists first and then behavior analysts second. And I think as such, we have just a really unique mindset when it comes to evaluating the field. And so, you know, over the past several years, we really started to notice this shift in the vernacular that behavior analysts were using. So we started to hear these words like compassionate care and trauma-informed practice. And what was really interesting to us was that, you know, we watched kind of all the behavior analysts around us get really excited about these new terms. But for us, you know, these were essential tenets of psychology. And so it became really clear to us that, you know, maybe behavior analysts could benefit from going back to their roots a little bit and learning more about certain aspects of psychology that could maybe help them in their practice. And so that's kind of how the idea for the book was born.
That is so awesome. You know, I love that, you know, you guys want to bring it back to the roots, because the thing is, like, you know, we do all of these things and we stay compassionate care and trauma-informed approaches as if it's a brand new, like, popularized term. But the truth is, it's been around for so long. And so it's really interesting. And I'm so glad that you've created and written this book, you know, to really help behavior analysts go back to their roots.
So it's been a really fun adventure kind of going through all of this. And I should say too, we had some incredible co-authors on this book. So while Lauren and I very much, you know, we probably wrote, I think we figured out we wrote about half of the book ourselves, but we have some incredible co-authors on a lot of these chapters for areas that are already doing some really cool stuff, kind of bridging these fields together. So we'll hopefully give them a shout out as we're talking as well.
Absolutely. You know, and speaking of different areas of the book, you know, the book covers a wide range of topics, like you said, you know, from child development to trauma-informed care. Can you explain why these topics are essential for behavior analysts to really know when they're practicing ABA? And not only that, but teaching their technicians to practice ABA with that approach.
Absolutely. And I'm really glad you brought up that point of technicians as well, because I think that that's so important that we never forget, although we kind of live in this tiered system model, you know, we are always going to be lifelong learners. So whether that's our first day on the job as an RBT or whether we've been doing this for 15 years, we have to make sure that we're constantly learning. So we really, when we were conceptualizing this and just in the works, we were really trying to look for what we were seeing as training gaps in university programs. Lauren and I have both taught in a couple of different university training programs. And these were things that we would just kind of have, you know, when we would get together for catch-up, we would have these conversations of, hey, do you ever notice that, like, there is nothing in the curriculum about any kind of trauma responsive care? There is nothing about child development. Like, how are we preparing this next generation of BCBAs if we don't have these topics? So we kind of started from those kind of personal professional conversations we were having. And then we really spent some time reflecting on that separation or that kind of divorce between behavior analysis and psychology in the 1960s. And we thought a little bit about kind of how that split has led to a lot of the current criticisms in ABA, maybe not directly, but indirectly. We really considered how a lot of those buzzwords, like Lauren mentioned, trauma-informed care, value-based care, compassionate care, how they're really infiltrating the marketing of behavior analysis in particular. And that can really be a double-edged sword. Sometimes people say they're, you know, really focused on compassionate care, but then you might kind of see a session and say, that's not what's going on here. So we want to make sure that we're kind of covering the history between ABA and psychology and using that as the foundation of the book. And then talking about some more technical aspects, like specific therapeutic techniques, consultation and collaboration, assessment, and then some more conceptual things like history and child development, trauma, social justice. So we tried to identify those areas by that.
I love that so much. You know, I love that this is something that, like, you're really passionate about and that you really want to make sure that behavior analysts are really focusing on, you know, because again, you know, we do say those buzzwords all the time. And like you said, Erica, you know, you said that you might see a session all of a sudden, is compassionate care really what's happening here? You might say it, but is it actual fact?
Completely. Know? Yes, absolutely agree with that.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of like on the note of the trauma-informed care. You know, of course, this is very critical. It is a buzzword that people are saying, you know, in our field. Technicians are starting to even pick up on it too, but especially our BCBAs. How can behavior analysts really integrate trauma-informed practices into their work? How do you feel about that?
I can take a first swing at this, and then Lauren, if you want to kind of add anything after that, you can feel free to. For me, this is maybe one of the most essential oversights in our training. We certainly think about learning histories. You know, learning histories is one of those things that, you know, we try to make that one-to-one relationship of, okay, there's the analogy of learning history is to trauma, but there is so much more in the study of trauma that we just don't receive training on. You know, we're not familiar with those intricacies and the nuances that are really involved in trauma. So Jaredith Lord, Valbona Demiri, and I think Mary Jane Weiss, they worked on the chapter for trauma-informed care entitled Trauma-Informed Care for Behavior Analysts. So they do a really beautiful job of providing an overview of the psychological concepts of trauma, attachment, learned helplessness. And then they really dive into the neurobiology of trauma, which I think, you know, is kind of way out of our scope of competence, but is really helpful background information for us to have about how the brain changes. And there is neurodivergence that comes about from that trauma. And how it can present. And one of the biggest takeaways is that we as behavior analysts really need to acknowledge trauma as the first step towards being trauma responsive. And a big part of that for me is we have to make sure that as ABA providers, we are acknowledging the trauma and harm that has been done to autistics. So that is another big kind of component of this trauma is we're really quick to kind of sweep that under the rug and not talk about the harm that was done, particularly in that kind of Lavos style, discrete trial, intensive 40 plus hour a week format. But that's the first step to being trauma responsive is to acknowledge the trauma. And I think we have to start doing that as a field.
Agreed. Lauren, I would love to get your thoughts on this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think when it comes to trauma, there are so many, you know, it's a buzzword in and of itself. And then there's so many additional phrases that you hear, right? So there's trauma-informed care, there's trauma responsiveness, there's trauma-focused care. And I think it's really important to have a good understanding of what each of those things are so that when you're talking about it correctly. Because, you know, trauma-informed is one thing, you know, being knowledgeable about the fact that, you know, we're going to recognize the potential impact of trauma on this individual, you know, that can lead to trauma-informed care. But that's very different than trauma-focused care, where you're actually trying to work through the trauma with the individual and help them identify and process ways to cope. And so I think those nuances are really important because a lot of times, again, you hear people, oh yeah, we're doing trauma-informed ABA. Well, what does that actually mean? Because there's a big difference between acknowledging the potential for trauma and actually trying to work through it. So lots of nuances there.
Well yeah. Said, Lauren. Yeah.
Well said for sure. And I'm really glad, Lauren, that you touched on the differences, you know, making sure that we know the differences between those. I remember hosting a CEU, I believe it was last August or no, it was last October now. About trauma-informed care from a behavior analyst point of view. And there were people who didn't like the fact that I actually acknowledged some of that trauma. They were saying, oh, you know, just because this is happening, you know, it was like the feedback that was given was like they wanted to dismiss it. And, you know, to sit there and say, oh, well, I'm trauma-informed, I provide compassionate care and be totally informed of what's happening with autistic people, are you truly being trauma-informed?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I mean, also just acknowledging that kind of systemic medical gaslighting that can happen, that like, oh, it's not trauma, you just had a bad X, Y, or Z, or oh, that wasn't really trauma, like that can further complicate the actual trauma disorder and lead to more complex PTSD symptoms as well. So completely hear you on that.
It's also why there are so many autistic people who do have PTSD too. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, think about, you know, I'm going to acknowledge the JRC, mm-hmm. you know, the shock
Absolutely.
Therapy. I mean, come on, you know, you mm-hmm. can't, you know, there are people who still have said, oh, well, they'll say, why is this happening? But then it's like, why are you like showing a side on this? I have to, as a behavior analyst,
yeah.
like,
yeah.
and, you know, so it's like, how can you sit there and dismiss right. autistic people's concerns?
Mm-hmm. Because neutrality is a stance, right? You know, it's like some things you gotta have a feeling on. That's my take.
Exactly. And I'm gonna jump a little bit because, you know, because of the fact that autistics do tend to have more like PTSD symptoms as a result of bad ABA. I want to make that very clear. Bad ABA can cause PTSD. Mm-hmm. The good, the actually compassionate, the actually trauma-focused care does not produce PTSD, but the bad stuff absolutely does. There have been criticisms of ABA from the autistic community, and that's especially so. So that being said, how does your book address these concerns, and what changes do you propose to make ABA not just more inclusive and respectful, but more actually like trauma focused?
Definitely. So it's a big question, and I am so grateful that we have a lot of autistic advocates who are in the field who are writing on this topic right now. I'm so glad that we have folks who can speak to their lived experience in a way that we as practitioners who are holistic really cannot understand. So I was just re-familiarizing myself with Sneha Mathur's article that she put out. It was just a couple months ago, I believe. And I think that she really did, she and her co-authors did such an amazing job of kind of summarizing those five core criticisms of ABA. You know, she talked about erasure of autistic identity and kind of promoting masking as one of the things that, you know, can seem innocuous. And I myself, reflecting back, absolutely was guilty of doing this without even realizing in my early career, you know, looking at, you know, how it can cause those worsening mental health, or, you know, even be the cause of worsening mental health and that trauma, looking at component behaviors rather than looking at the whole person. That's another big area of criticism. Where are the autistic voices in research and practice, and why aren't we listening to them? Even worse yet, why are we silencing them when they are speaking up as well? And then that pressure for parents to choose ABA. I think she summarized those five really well. And I think we incorporated some of that into our chapter, but we kind of took a very broad approach of the criticism. So, you know, definitely we have that chapter that focuses a lot on trauma. We also have another chapter that focuses on comorbidities and diagnosis and how diagnosis can be both harmful and helpful, and a little bit about medical versus social model of disability in there too. But we really tried to look at, we kind of identified about 8 or 9 core criticisms. And then we wrote a chapter about it. That's really what we did. That's the approach we took in our introduction. We sort of said, hey, here are the things that we're seeing as big criticisms. Even, you know, I know you're active on social media as well, Michelle. You know, we've only been on social media for about 6 months, and boy, has that been a learning curve, because you do. I mean, there is just, anytime you put those four letters BCBA after your name, you know, there is a connotation that comes along with it. Some of it founded, some of it very much not. And, you know, on, I think there kind of is this mounting crisis that's happening in the field. So I think it's really important to not only acknowledge those criticisms, but delve into them and start reading that critical literature as well. So we're looking at, you know, ABA doesn't always consider developmental appropriateness. So we really tried to have a chapter that Lauren and her co-author wrote about, hey, let's talk about child development and provide that essential background knowledge. Interpersonal skills is a big thing we hit on in here. Not only just consultation and collaboration, but listening skills. I think that, you know, that active listening is not a passive verb, it's an active verb. Really focusing on that. We've definitely got a lot more in there about cultural responsiveness, and we've got our former colleague Brea Banks, who's actually still a professor at Illinois State. She does some incredible work, and she had quite a few of her students co-write a chapter about socially just ABA practices. And that is one of the chapters that I think is like the hardest to read, but maybe the most relevant and important one to look at, particularly for those that do represent, you know, young white women, which is the majority of BCBAs in our field. But I think that that's a really essential reading to look at, you know, things like microaggressions, look at systems, look at the way that we promote and perpetuate some saviorism. So we kind of took that approach of let's look at these criticisms and let's just write a chapter about it to address that. So that was kind of our approach.
Love it. I love it. You know, I love that that is such a big highlight. And, you know, you really do such a great job of just like breaking it down, you know, to be able, because the thing is, like, we need to know our history. We need to know that ABA is not just a one set thing. There are so many different components. You have to consider all of these things. You know, you have to consider child development. You have to consider cultural responsiveness and cultural competency even too. You know, you have to consider all of these different areas, not just, oh, hey, here's the four functions of behavior. This is what the child is doing. I mean, honestly, I really appreciate that you guys are breaking that down in your book so, so nicely.
For sure. And it's not, I mean, I think the one criticism we'll likely get is it's not parsimonious, right? And it's like, we're breaking that kind of cardinal rule of ABA of like, yeah, we are introducing more complexity here, but we're also just introducing further background knowledge. So we're not saying that this is going to be the definitive thing that makes your decision as a behavior analyst, but it will make you a better, more well-rounded BCBA.
Yeah. And yeah, respectfully, does it have to be parsimonious?
I think that maybe behavior analysts just prefer the parsimony. We'll maybe make it a strong preference, but not a requirement.
Yeah, exactly. And so kind of going back to some of the topics that you guys discussed, you know, I know that one of your chapters focuses on the intersection between child development and learning. So how do you think that understanding child development improves behavior analytic practices for our behavior analysts?
Well, you know, Michelle, I think one of the things that's interesting, because so specifically this chapter has to do with typical child development, mm-hmm. right? And okay. That's unique because as most behavior analysts are maybe working with children who are not following a typical trajectory, but it is super important to understand typical development, because if you don't know how a child should be developing, then you're not going to be super great at identifying when maybe they've gotten a little bit off track. And I think one of the best examples that I usually see with this is for tantrums. So, you know, I often will see clinicians who are targeting, you know, reduction of tantrums in behavior plans, right? We're trying to reduce or eliminate these behaviors. And depending on the age of your learner, tantrums could be a completely normal part of development, right?
Yeah.
You know, when you work with a neurotypical toddler, tantrums are expected. And we don't try to fix them or make it so they don't happen anymore, because we know that most toddlers don't have the skills yet to actively regulate their behaviors. And so that same thing, it serves true for autistic toddlers. And so it's important for us to know, like, hey, this is typical, right? Tantrums are typical. So we don't need to change it just because the child is autistic. And so that knowledge of how children are typically developing is super important, I think, for practitioners who work with children, but even more so, you know, those who are working with children on the autism spectrum.
Yeah, Listen, I am so happy that you talked about tantrums specifically. So funny enough, we were actually sent something from ABA Visualized about, mm-hmm. you know, the differences between tantrums for like how often does a neurotypical child engage in a tantrum? How often does a neurotypical child engage in like biting? And there was a breakdown of the ages. And I remember seeing that on Instagram. And I also just remember like reviewing so many treatment plans, because one of my jobs was to actually review treatment plans, and seeing like for a 3-year-old, reduce tantrums to zero. And it's like, do you like want to make your child mask for the rest of their lives? Because I don't know a single 3-year-old that doesn't cry. I don't even know a single adult that doesn't cry at least like once a month, Like,
Absolutely.
come on, So I'm so glad that you mentioned this, Lauren, because this is something that I feel like, from the view of a behavior analyst and writing down, specific goals and specific skill acquisition goals, behavior reduction goals, we need to think about what is considered quote unquote neurotypical for a neurotypical learner versus an autistic learner. We shouldn't just eliminate or, decrease something if it's number one, not age typical or age appropriate, and number two, if it's not socially significant to do so,
Yep, absolutely.
I just witnessed my 3-year-old. My daughter just turned 3 this past weekend, and I was overhearing her with my partner. And there were, I mean, I, there was like a probably a good 3, 5 minute duration of a tantrum, probably over, just like discontinuing cuddles. I mean, it's just you just can't. You've just got to remember that, and maybe it's going to make more sense to write a goal that's saying, "Hey, we're going to maybe look at tantrums, and we're going to look at what is the typical duration of a tantrum for a toddler, which you can't predict. I mean, that range is
True.
massive. But maybe let's look at something that's a little more in line with kind of the human experience for a tantrum."
Exactly. And then also too, replacement behaviors, looking at like what can we teach our children, that could be a replacement behavior. But even then, still, we focus so much on eliminating or decreasing behaviors, and it's like, at what point do we say maybe we should stop focusing on what we don't want our kids to do and start focusing on what our kids really should be
Completely.
doing? So, and with that being said, I kind of want to jump to cultural responsiveness too, because I feel like, with age typical, age appropriate, that can also kind of tie in with cultural competence and kind of what families expect. So cultural responsiveness is another significant topic in your book. So can you discuss how behavior analysts can be more culturally responsive in their practice with their clients, with their technicians, and probably the most important, with the families that they serve?
Completely. And I'll preface this with a little positionality statement. I'm second generation American. My dad's an immigrant. I am a non-heritage Spanish speaker. I am disabled. I am queer, and all of these things lead to the perfect little intersectional identity that I have. And I think that what is so important and why this has always come up is something that is very relevant to me is our ethical code now specifically calls for cultural responsiveness and diversity, non-discrimination, non-harassment, awareness of personal biases. But now we often in this field use compliance as the ceiling rather than the floor. So oftentimes we are not so much looking to acquire those skills, but we're just trying to reduce the behaviors that are out of compliance with that. So I'm just that's throwing that out there. It's really messy when you have demographics of individuals who are serving populations that kind of are somewhat mismatched, and that can be across a wide variety of different kinds of identities, whether that's a different language, whether that's different cultural practices, whether that is the way that you're kind of coming in, and it might be kind of reminding them of a bad experience that they've had with someone else in the past, all of those learning history things. But this chapter written by Dr. Brea Banks and some of her incredible graduate students really focuses on the essential concepts about diversity, equity, and inclusion, the concept of neurodiversity, and really kind of going into a little bit more about implicit bias, about ableism, about how ableism affects our field, intersecting identities, social justice. And I think that those things are just, again, really great prerequisite knowledge. But one of the things I love the most about the chapter that Dr. Banks and her students wrote is their discussion of microaggressions, which is really the area of research focus that Bray has been working on for several years now, and how those microaggressions can be, nobody is immune from using those microaggressions. There can be, across gender, across sexuality, ability, race, citizenship, language. They really take a nice ecological approach in that chapter, and they try to kind of provide micro as well as macro recommendations. They look at, how we're going to advocate at multiple levels to move our field forward. And, that doesn't necessarily mean showing up in political contexts, but how can we, at the companies where we're working, ensure that, we have documents translated into the languages that we're serving? How can we ensure that, we're making a concerted effort to hire individuals who are representative of the populations that we're serving as well? And that's also going to be including autistic individuals. So I think that is kind of the long and short of their chapter. I think, as I said before, it can be maybe a difficult one to read because we're going to be confronted with a lot of privilege. For many people reading it, privilege can come from all kinds of different areas. It's not just one kind of privilege. It's not just white privilege. It can be, bodied privilege, for instance. So I think it's a very important one to read, and it does provide some really good specific recommendations of what we can be doing as behavior analysts in the field.
And it's interesting you say that too, because privilege is something that we run into. As behavior analysts, we do run into, we have our own set of privileges that other people don't have. Like I, for instance, even though I am autistic, I am a white woman. I grew up in a middle-class family. I grew up, now my parents are divorced, but I grew up with a mom who really took care of me and loved me. And I'm really happy that, and I'm privileged in that sense. And I think it's really important, and I'm glad you talk about this because, yes, it's probably going to be a really hard chapter to read, quite frankly, because we're going to be called out. We're going to be saying, we're going to be told, hey, do better, essentially, mm-hmm. I would imagine. And even with that, we have to be called out in order to change our own behavior, because behavior analysis is all about behavior change, right?
Completely. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah. I think it's really, I think that there's kind of this, I've sort of conceptualized this as like mental health saviorism. So like sometimes as mental health professionals, behavioral health professionals, and this can even be applied to the field of medicine too, you have all of this, niche knowledge, and you sometimes go into situations thinking, I have the quote unquote cure. I have the thing that this person needs in order to succeed. I'm the one that knows better. And you're not recognizing the power differential and the power dynamics in that situation. So I think that is a very, very important point as well.
Factual. So factual. And even between that too, another chapter of the book that we need to call attention to is the history, because ABA has been through some steam pile rolling crap. we have to be honest with ourselves, right? Yeah. Privilege is not only something we need to be honest about, but our history needs to be something. So you mentioned the historical separation between behavior analysis and other psychological approaches like cognitivism in the 1960s. How has this drift impacted the field of ABA, and why do you feel it's important to bridge this gap now in 2024?
Yeah, this is a tricky question because I think the answer probably depends on who you ask. Behavior analysts very intentionally separated themselves from psychology, but I think it's super important to acknowledge the fact that we were all one at one point in time, because I don't believe that, lots of people get kind of a good training on our background in history when they decide to become a BCBA. Really wasn't until Skinner started to kind of rise in his influence and become that face of behaviorism that then we started to pull apart. And that was like 1930s, 1940s. And Skinner started to kind of pull everything apart from psychology, started to, you know, acknowledge maybe this is its own field, or we want it to be its own field. And then once we got into the 1960s, we had the cognitive revolution, and we like officially split, you know, behavior analysis kind of went on its own way. And then psychology went more towards the mentalistic cognitivism route. And this happened a long time ago, like you said. So none of this is new information. But I think that the reason that the gap needs to be bridged now more than ever before is because of the criticisms that we've already kind of talked about today. You know, I think we can perhaps find that some of these answers that we're searching for in terms of how do we become better practitioners, how do we do better by the patients that we're serving, maybe some of them can be found by looking into our history, by looking at, you know, where we came from. And that's psychology. So I think there's a lot there, and I think there's a lot that can be learned and be potentially useful for behavior analysts.
And yeah. Go ahead, Michelle.
No, I was saying, yeah. No, please continue.
Oh, no, I was going to add one thing to that, Lauren, too, because I think that something I've found out, and you've maybe seen this as well, Michelle, through social media, is just like, it is just so wild to me how I see revisionist histories of the psychology ABA split on both ends. So there are some folks coming from psychology backgrounds who are like, what are you talking about? ABA is a branch of psychology. And then you have folks in behavior analysis who are like, we were never connected with psychology. And even to the point, I've had some folks tell me that in their training programs that they're specifically taught that they did not stem from psychology, that they were always a hard science, that they were always kind of this derivative from Pavlov's physio research with, you know, dog salivation. So, I mean, I think that it's just very interesting, but like when you look at the backgrounds of all of our, you know, our founders of the field, when you look at Skinner, when you look at Beowulf Risley, when you look at Watson, you look at all these folks and they've got psychology in common. And I think it's just very interesting because like Lauren said, it so depends who you ask.
Yeah. I mean, I'll even tell you right now, I don't remember hearing about ABA being a branch of psychology, like being taught to me in grad school. I was taught the same thing, that ABA was its own science. And I would argue, I mean, even back then, I would have argued, I was a sociology minor in college. Yeah, cool. Sociology is a part of psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And sociology and ABA also have its own components. And guess what? They're also part of psychology.
Yeah.
How can you sit there and say that, no, ABA is its own evidence-based science and it is its own thing and, you know, ABA is it, you know, it is just that. Like, no, I would argue, like, I would have argued back then, too, as I started grad school. And I was in grad school 10 years ago, just to age myself here.
It is like everything always comes back to Hamilton for me, Hamilton the musical. And it is, it's who lives, who dies, who tells your story. I mean, it is very interesting. It is who you ask and how they tell what the history is between these two disciplines.
And it's amazing to hear that the history is just not spoken enough about. It's amazing in the worst kind of way, but it's amazing nonetheless, you know? And again, you know, I think it just kind of goes to show you that we have to go back to our roots. We have to go back, not what we were told in grad school necessarily. Mm. And I don't want to dismiss anyone who is in grad school or a grad school professor here, but I do want to say we need to really get back, because ABA really is a form of psychology. When you think about it, you know, sociology is also a form of psychology. You know, different types of like behavioral therapy, DBT, CBT, those are all psychology branches underneath that umbrella, you know? So it's amazing. It's amazing in the worst kind of way that unfortunately there are people who do think that. And if you want to argue with me, no, I'm kidding. Honestly, it's so true. It is so true that it is quite sad. So I'm really glad that we're having this conversation today to discuss that. So, well, I want to go ahead and toss out our first code word of the podcast. The first code word of the podcast is psych. That is PSYCH, psych. Something that we have been talking about pretty much the entire podcast, psychology. So, kind of on the note of psychology, and one of the things that we had talked a little bit about before was psychotherapeutic techniques. Because ABA is a branch of psychology. How do you think behavior analysts, and I would love to hear from the both of you on this, how do you think behavior analysts use the principles from psychotherapeutic techniques in their daily practice, going back to psychology?
Yeah, so this was a chapter that I worked on with actually I think it was your former intern, is that right, Lauren?
Yes, I'm one of my
Alexandria.
former practicum students.
Yeah, one of your
Yes.
former practicum students, Alexandria, and she and I, we really kind of took the approach of identifying theories and practices that were adjacent to behavior analysis. And by that, I mean therapeutic practices that include components of a behavioral orientation. So we didn't want to like come in really strong and be like, oh, and this very much is just an example. This is not my theoretical orientation. We don't want to be talking about psychoanalysis. We don't want to be talking about Rorschach inkblot tests. We wanted to stick with things that at least had a behavioral component. So we kind of have a foot in the door to get some buy-in from some behavior analysts on these techniques. We figured this would be easier to digest, and it also respond it also kind of promotes responsible practices and helps us to ensure that we are staying as close as possible to our scope of competence as behavior analysts as well. What I sort of consider the biggest takeaways from this chapter is number one, pairing and instructional control are part of the equation. They are not the entire equation of rapport and therapeutic alliance. We've now been getting, again, when doing some readings and listening to autistic advocates on this topic as well, like some folks really hate pairing practices. Like they feel icky, they feel forced, it feels compliance driven. And that's really when we talk about rapport and behavior analysis, that is all that we talk about is pairing and instructional control. So that is one big part is like, hey, that's not all of it. There are other techniques that can really enhance and build that therapeutic alliance with clients and families and consultees. That really involves us as behavior analysts learning to engage in listening behavior. So again, like I said before, listening is not a passive verb, it is an active verb. We talk about specific active listening skills. We talk about specific lines of questioning that can be used, like some things from solution-focused brief therapy, asking the miracle question of, if you woke up tomorrow and this problem were better, what would that look like for you? So just giving kind of those guides and examples of things that very much come from therapeutic techniques. But we also talk about brief family therapy. We talk about systems. We talk about the systems of change and how we have to kind of consider that, we're going to have a parent or caregiver come in to caregiver sessions with us, and they're not going to be in a place to hear what we have prepared. And maybe the best thing that they need from us right then is to just focus on hearing them and figure out a plan for moving forward, and that also has value. And parent-child interaction therapy, looking at just like adjacent modalities and kind of potential areas so that behavior analysts, if they read something in that chapter that they're like, hey, I really want to learn more about PCIT, they then have the right words to search for getting continuing education on those topics.
Yeah, it's an action-packed chapter.
It is action-packed. Yes.
I love it. I love it.
Lauren's being facetious.
No, I'm not. It really is. Well, you mentioned so many things, and I think my favorite part of that chapter, you know, we talk about active listening a lot. And I think active listening, it's so interesting because, you know, you hear that term and it's like, oh, yeah, no, that's easy, right? I just listen. And then you smile and you nod. But there's actually like so many components that come with active listening. And we talk about some of those in that chapter. And so things like, you know, summarizing what somebody's saying after they said it, you know, that shows somebody that you are listening to understand, you know, you're not listening to respond. You know, just sometimes just being silent too, just being silent and not saying anything shows somebody that you are truly listening. And then there's a few other things that we talk about in terms of, like Erica mentioned questioning. So, you know, using open-ended questions, not closed-ended questions, and, you know, affirming the way that they're feeling so that, you know, they understand you heard them and you're acknowledging that this is hard for them right now. You're not glossing over it and then asking them to take a bunch of data on their child's behavior problems. So there's just a lot that goes into like a seemingly innocuous skill like active listening. And so that's something that we really unpack in that chapter.
Agreed. Yeah.
I'm so glad that that's something you guys actually unpack. You know, and it's something that I think about too when it comes to, you know, my own clients, my own families, and when I work with them, you know, when I work with the families specifically, you know, I'm looking at them and I'm saying, you know, I'm not here to tell you what to do. You are first and foremost, you are your child's best advocate.
Absolutely. Okay? Yes.
That is like my number one rule. And my number two rule is, you know, what you say here is, you know, you need to feel safe with me. Because and this is something that I remind people, I am a guest in their life. They can choose to kick me out at any moment in time. If they decide I've no longer provided a safe space for them, that I no longer acknowledge their concerns, I no longer am being a compassionate person. And I say compassionate person, not a compassionate behavior analyst. Because yes, I am a behavior analyst, but that is second to being a human. If I'm not promoting those things, then I've not done my job, quite frankly, you know, and I feel like that has to be iterated and reiterated over and over again, you know, to anybody who is listening to this. I really cannot emphasize enough, be a human first and a behavior analyst, assistant behavior analyst, technician, whatever you are, second.
You know, that is such a beautiful example of humble behaviorism right there. Like that is like everything that you just said just so personifies what it means to come to the table as a humble practitioner. And I agree with you 100%.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. And I mean, honestly, like the hardest part is I feel like, and this is something that I have seen, some people will get their credential and automatically think they are the Jesus Christ of their field or of the company. And I'm sorry, but no, you're not. First of all, respectfully, no. Second of all, you know, if you're not being a kind human being, then that's not the kind of human that I want to be interacting
with. Yeah, I agree. You know. Lauren and I often talk about hero worship in the field. And I think that what you're touching on is really related to that. This notion of, oh, I worked under so-and-so, or, oh, I got this, you know, specialization, or I, you know, wrote this paper, or I worked on this project. And I think that, you know, while so many fields have that element, the hero worship in behavior analysis is so kind of prominent because a lot of our heroes are still alive and well because our field is so young. I think that along with, you know, feeling like, okay, I got my credentials, I know everything, this egotism is really, can eat away at the effectiveness of our science as a whole.
Yeah. And unfortunately it's very easy for people to get egotistical, because they get their credential and they pass this exam. I mean, you know, the thing is, it's great that you passed this exam. It took me a few times to pass the exam, but that doesn't make you any more of a behavior analyst, and it doesn't make you any less of a behavior analyst.
Nope.
You have to be a human first, because the heart of ABA is within the heart.
100%.
Not within, not necessarily within the brain. You know? You know, and kind of on the notion of behavior analysts and, you know, giving advice, let's talk a little bit about what we can give advice to for newly credentialed behavior analysts and those in training. I actually supervise a few BCBA candidates to, you know, become a BCBA someday. And this is a really near and dear topic to my heart that I try to really practice with, especially my behavior analysts in training. What would you say if I were to, you know, like show them the book or give them a few chapters, what would you say specific chapters or sections of the book would you recommend that they focus on first?
Well, for the newly certified practitioners, I would start with the basics. And so, you know, the first few chapters of our book, and we've talked a little bit about these topics already, you know, the introduction to child development and therapeutic techniques. You know, I think that's a good place to start because, as you just mentioned, Michelle, the importance of being a human first, that cannot be understated. And so, you know, that therapeutic technique chapter, I think, really lays the foundation for what people are talking about when they're saying things about compassionate care and trauma-informed care. There's just these really important skills that are just at the basis of human interactions that sometimes I think behavior analysts, they struggle with. And that's the basis of interacting with caregivers, interacting with your learners. And so that's what I would recommend in terms of just really focusing on the therapeutic techniques and the child development. Erica, do you have any other additions?
I agree with everything that you just said, Lauren. I would also add there is a chapter about consultation and collaboration written by one of my former mentors, Lauren Lestromo Allen, and her colleague, Dr. Mount. They do such a great job of preparing, you know, one thing as school psychologists, Lauren and I, we received a specific course in consultation and collaboration. And I know that that is not typically something that is involved in behavior analytic verified course sequences, but yet we have a lot of behavior analysts who their first position is working in a school. And, you know, and obviously in more clinical settings, too, you're having to do a lot of consultation and collaboration. But if you're particularly working in a school, I would also add that chapter in particular, which is, I think, our fifth chapter in there.
Absolutely. I love that. I love that so much. And, you know, especially when it comes to the BCBA candidates, you know, I'm curious to know, like, what are areas that maybe like I as a supervisor can really hone in on when I'm doing my group supervision meetings with my BCBA candidates?
I mean, I know we've already sung the praises of chapter 6, which is our socially just ABA chapter, but I mean, it's truly fantastic. And that is what I would recommend for more seasoned practitioners, supervisors. I mean, really, really focusing in on the culturally responsiveness. It's just, I can't understate how great that chapter is. So that I think for sure. There's also towards the end of the book, we have a chapter on psychopathology, where we kind of talk about the DSM, you know, the manual that psychologists use for diagnosing. And I think it's unique, right? It sheds some light on the medical model of diagnoses versus the social model. We talk a little bit about how various diagnoses are made. And so I think that chapter as well is and could be super informative for more of those veteran BCBAs or supervisors.
Absolutely.
Erica, any that I'm missing?
I'd agree with that as well. I think that one is definitely, those two chapters are great places to start. I think, you know, a lot of that depends on kind of the needs of supervisees, but as you were saying, group supervision, that really made me think, Michelle, that we have a chapter that's actually on statistics, which probably is incredibly overwhelming for a lot of folks. Dr. Kristen Padilla and Grant Morgan worked on that chapter. And I think that I was revisiting it because we were doing a series on it. I think last week or 2 weeks ago we were working on that, and I think just remembering that although we get so much training in single case design, I think that it's so essential to be an effective consumer of literature, and that means going outside the behavior analytic literature. And you really need to understand group level statistics at a very, you know, this chapter does a good job of making it very simple. You know, it's not going to give you everything you would get in a stats course necessarily, but it helps you understand, you know, some basic statistical principles so that you could at least could be a better surveyor of that knowledge. And our chapters on legal and ethical, as well as our assessment chapter, I think, again, if you're in a group situation setting where kind of those ethical concerns are things that are coming up, or assessment, specifically looking at, you know, curriculum types of assessment, standardized assessment, looking at, you know, what is or is not in the scope of competence for BCBAs to do. I think those three chapters would really be good jumping off points for a group supervision or kind of a practicum discussion for kind of more advanced students or more seasoned BCBAs.
I love that. And I, when I get the book, because I already pre-ordered it. yes. I'm definitely going to take a look at those because, you know, for me personally, when I'm doing like my group supervisions with my candidates or when I'm talking with my candidates in general, you know, a big thing that I really hone in on is, you know, first of all, you need to know your history. Second of all, you need to know actually how to be compassionate and not just say you're compassionate and say, you know, you're all these things. But third of all, too, one of the big things I think about is, you know, you talked about standardized assessments, and we talked about, like, some of the things that we talk about together is, yes, a standardized assessment has specific criteria, but the thing is, ABA is an individualized approach, mm-hmm. and it's not just about pulling goals from the VB map pulling goals from the ABLE, which, let's be honest, let me tell you how many times I've seen some of those assessments where it's like, for example, I remember seeing a 17-year-old get an assessment in, and they did the VB map and the ABLEs, first of all. Second of all, the thing was like, the goal was like, oh, he's going to do intraverbal fill-ins. I don't remember the exact verbiage, but intraverbal fill-ins of songs. And it's like, are you kidding me?
Social significance. Let's back it up to that social significance for a second. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Put your brain on. Respectfully put your brain on and realize, hey, you know, this is an individualized approach. Mm-hmm. This person, you know, needs to have skills that are socially significant to them, because another thing, and I'm sure you guys cover this in the book, but as an autistic adult, autistic children become autistic adults.
Yep.
You know? So, well, absolutely. I'm going to go ahead and toss that second and final code word. And that second and final code word is therapeutic. That is therapeutic. That is therapeutic. All right, so I do have a couple of last questions for you ladies. I would love to get an answer from the both of you on this particular question. What do you see as the future direction of ABA with the integration of psychological principles?
I can go ahead and take this one to start, Erica.
Sure.
You know, I think I really hope for a future that has just more well-rounded clinicians. Clinicians who understand the value of perspectives outside their own, who know the importance of social validity, even if maybe it clashes with their data. I think behavior analysis is truly an amazing science, but, you know, we need to stop being on our own islands and being proud of that, because I do think that we're proud of the fact that we're islands. But there's so much value in collaborating and learning from others and, you know, just getting an awareness of where we came from. Like Erica said, the revisionist histories that we're continually hearing about, you know, it is important to appreciate our history so that we can effectively secure our future. And I know that that sounds silly, but
sounded great. You know, I don't know what you're talking about.
I think that there's probably something to learn from our past, and I think that behavior analysts can benefit from certain aspects of psychology, and I think it will turn them into better clinicians and practitioners.
I agree with all of that. I think that it's also, you know, that history can be cyclical. And I think that not only can we learn better to do better, but we also need to be aware of the red flags of when we see, you know, some of those not so great things from our history coming back around again, because these things are very much cyclical. In addition to just creating more well-rounded clinicians, I think Lauren and I, we feel very strongly about critical friendship. So being a critical friend, meaning being someone who cares very deeply and values the behavior analytic science, someone who wants to make behavior analysis better, someone who asks hard questions and incorporates things from other disciplines to add richness and liven up these discussions. I hope that we help others to be critical friends of ABA, because in order for ABA to be stronger, we need more critical friends.
Agreed. I love that so much. And I think you guys summed it up beautifully. I mean, I think I'm on that same boat, you know, as far as what your guys's future directions are. I think, you know, really also to understanding that it is okay to be a human first, because behavior analysts are so, like, some people believe that being a BCBA is also their personality and should be their lifelong, you know, identity. And that's great, but, you know, that's not great when you're trying to develop relationships, and it's not great when you're trying to make meaningful relationships with others, you know, or anything like that, you know. So to me, I find that so beautiful. I find it so true. And, you know, for me personally, like, I'm completely in alignment with that.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And finally, what key takeaway? Now, I'm sure there's probably a lot of answers on this, but what would you say is at least one, maybe two key takeaways that you would like listeners to remember from your book?
I would definitely say we're stronger together than apart. I think that we've been a fairly siloed discipline for a while now. And I think that we can still maintain the integrity of our behavior science while incorporating useful evidence-based techniques from adjacent fields. And my other big one is, you know, that we need to be better listeners. And sometimes that means being quiet. Sometimes that means using that silence and letting the other individual know that you are hearing them. We need to listen to our clients. We need to listen to the autistic community, and we need to listen to other fields. And we have to value listening behaviors as a critical element of our skill set as behavior analysts.
That's really well said, Erica.
Oh, thanks.
I think so. I shameless plug, since that's what this podcast is about, right? The very last chapter of our book, we address all of these things exactly, like key takeaways. And we list like about 10, I think. But what I would add to what Erica said is just remembering that you're not the smartest person in the room. And amen. I think that is a hard thing to swallow sometimes, but, you know, collaboration, consultation, interdisciplinary, you know, coordination, it is super important. It enhances social validity, and it makes us better practitioners.
Lovely. I love that so much, you know. And again, I'm super excited to read your book. So I am really excited. I'm waiting for the mail, waiting for my Amazon to email me with, hey, your shipment is coming. So very, very excited about this. So thank you so much, Erica and Lauren, for spending this time with me,
yeah,
talking about the book, telling me a little bit about, you know, everything that's involved in the book. My last question to you guys is, where can listeners find your book, and how can they stay up to date with you?
Yeah, for sure. So, it means so much to us that you ordered the book because honestly, Lauren and I had no clue what we were doing when we started writing this book. We were just like, let's write a book. And we've learned a lot along the way, but it means so much that you went out of your way to buy it. So, thank you for doing that. If anybody is interested, we have it. I think it's out for pre-order now on Amazon. We'll go ahead and give you all the links so you have it in show notes. It also is available for pre-order through Rutledge starting tomorrow. So they will also, we have a discount code for 20% off of that if you get it through Rutledge directly as of tomorrow, which is going to be the 31st of July. So by the time this airs, it will be available for pre-order. The book itself, you'll have to wait a little bit for that email from Amazon, Michelle, because it will be out on August 21st. So it will actually get to you in little less than a month. We're also going to be having a free virtual book launch on September 4th at 7:30 Eastern, and I'll send the registration link as well. And we're going to hopefully raffle off a free copy of the book for anybody who attends. And it's just going to be a free way. We're going to invite our authors to come on as well to just share a little more and see if that's something people are interested in learning more about. We're pretty active on social media. We try to make it a goal to post at least a couple posts and a couple reels every week at the Psychobabble BCBA. So that's usually the best way to keep up to date with us. But we also have a website that I'll include a link to, and we have a mailing list that you can sign up for on our website. If you have training inquiries about the book, or if you think that this is kind of a good fit for your organization or for you personally, you can feel free to also email us at hello@thepsychobabblebcbas.com. And then we also do have a continuing education event coming up with Kristen Peterson of Moralese. Her handle is ABA in the Wild. So she is just a lovely person that we have met through Instagram and became really fast friends with. And it's going to be on the topic of being a critical friend in ABA. And it's going to be, I think, 1.5 ethics CEUs. And we'll also share the registration link for that too.
Love it. I love
Yeah.
it. Oh, that is so
All
cool.
the things.
Yes, I love it so much. Well, thank you so much, Erica and Lauren, again for joining me tonight. And thank you, everyone who listened to this podcast. I have been your host, Michelle Zeman. Be sure to submit your CEU code words, and I will be back for the next one very soon. Bye, guys.
Thanks so much,
Bye.
Michelle.
Thank you.
Bye.